Jesus. And so that left a lot of people displaced. And the Jews, they brought back the Russian Jews, encouraged them to come back to their homeland. And so they came back. Millions of them came back to that little country. I don't know that they thought it through completely. But one of the interesting things about growing up in a communist country is that you learn a lot about your own trade, but you learn very little about anything else. One of my friends was a man by the name of Mikhail. Mikhail was a short, fat guy. I liked Mikhail because he was always smiling. But Mikhail was trained, since he was knee-high to a grasshopper, how to be an expert ballerinist. And I would not like to have even seen Mikhail in a ballerina outfit. But I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. He probably was much smaller at that point. But for 30-some years, he was trained to be a ballerinist and nothing else. All right? Now, how many ballerina jobs were available in Israel when millions of refugees come to that state for short, chubby guys? For that matter, all of these other Russian Jews who had been trained to do whatever job found themselves displaced and without a job in Israel. And so these folks raised in this communist society, they all knew how to do one thing, and they did it well. The other thing they knew how to do was drink vodka. And that's what they did. They became a problem for the state. They became alcoholics. And they needed help. And so I was working for a group called Project Nehemiah, and we would give baskets to these folks, and we'd give them a Bible. And I would go in there, and I was having enough trouble speaking Hebrew in the first place, let alone Russian. But I walked in one day, and I had a name and an address. This was before GPS. We had to use maps back then. You kids may learn about those in school. I don't know. But we got on the map, and we found the place. And I got up there, I knocked on the door, and this little kid comes in. And he opens the door, invites me in, and I'm trying to speak Hebrew. She's not understanding Hebrew. I'm trying to speak English. She has no idea what I'm saying. We're doing sign language. I'm dancing around. Nothing's happening. And I'm trying to let him know who I am. And the little boy that was there, he grabbed my coattail and he went like this. And he pointed to the refrigerator. And he had this picture that he drew. And the picture was one that I think all of us could know. Here there was this moat and this plank. And the little plank, or the little moat, or in that case, he had a little splinter sticking out of somebody's eye. All right? And the guy's kind of been over and he feels bad because he's being bullied. And there's this other guy, and the boy drew it to where there's a log sticking clear out of his head. And man, I knew exactly what it was. I said, and he said, we were communicating right there. And he looked at me and he figured out who I was. He said one word, Christian. Ema, he said, Christian. And at that point, we were able to communicate. Pharisees, they're always finding fault, aren't they? And they were doing that just this very night. They found fault with Christ's doctrine. They found fault with his demeanor. They were offended by the words of Christ. Folks, today, many are offended by Christ's words. And I don't know about you, but I've never set out to offend anyone with the gospel. But if we preach the gospel to America today, I will guarantee you, you're going to offend some people. If you preach the whole gospel. And you're not alone. You'll probably be hated. But remember what the Lord said to his disciples? They will hate you because they first hated me. Sometimes the gospel can be very, very offensive because it does not land on soil that's ready to receive it. Jesus, of course, offended these people. But this woman, she abandoned her native pagan traditions concerning all those gods of her land, and she reached across her land, and she went up on the mountain, and scaled this high mountain to find Jesus in his land. And she crossed taboos. A lot of them. Number one, she was a Gentile. Number two, she was a woman. Number three, she had this image of who God was. Her God, or gods, were the old Canaanite Phoenician gods. This was the worst area during the time of the evil kings of Israel. You remember a woman named Jezebel. You remember all of the Phoenicians that were in that area and how they worshiped Moloch and Baal. They find statues of Baal or Baal now. He's a big fat fella. And his arms are down and real short. He's kind of like a little T-Rex. But here he is. He's got little arms. And he's got a huge belly. And the belly is cut out. And it's really just a big stove. And underneath in these statues, there's an opening where you can draw the ashes out of the bottom. And what these folks would do is they would take their own children and they'd get that belly as hot as can be until Baal's stomach glowed red, and they'd take their children up and they'd set them right in that pot. And that's the type of worship that we found in this area, in the Canaanite area of Syrophoenicia. And here comes this woman. She finds Jesus. And she's willing to worship the God of heaven. These gods over here, they were the gods of Phoenicia, of Tyre, of Sidon. But Jehovah, he was the God of Israel. Now, the ancient world was very geocentric in their belief. They believed if they were a Moabite, you remember the book of Ruth? If they were a Moabite, then they worshiped the Moabite gods. Okay, just like Ruth did. But you have Naomi. She comes back to Israel. You remember Ruth says to Naomi, I will worship your God. You notice that? Because when she was in Moab, that wasn't her God. She had another God, but Israel had its God. And so these gods ruled over certain parts of the lands. And to her, Jehovah was Israel's God. But now she's willing to scale the mountain and go past everything, any geocentric taboo, any taboo that says she's a woman, any Gentile taboo. She doesn't care because she's got a daughter who has a great need. She doesn't seem to be offended at all. Her faith was higher than the mountain that she scaled. The Pharisees revered traditions, but this woman, she revered the truth of the Son of Man. The Pharisees, they had purpose, didn't they? Their purpose was not only to find fault with the disciples, but to trap Jesus. They were always seeking praise. Pharisees, that's their number one job. And yet here, she calls him Lord. You know, if she had only called him Lord, then we might say that it's the equivalent of saying sir. But she didn't, did she? She attached the title Son of David. Now, where did you hear that before? Remember the other night? Our blind man? Son of David, have mercy on me. This indicates that she knew something about the Jewish faith. And she was trusting that he was not only the Christ, the hope of Israel, but she trusted that that hope would extend beyond Israel's border. The Samaritan woman at the well, you remember her in John 4? She called Jesus the Christ. These Gentiles knew something about Jesus, didn't they? It was blind Bartimaeus that cried out to Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. The Pharisees, they were offended. And they were offensive. By the way, you'll find that most people in this world believe that people ought not to ever offend anybody else. If you offend somebody, you're the worst scoundrel that there's ever been that's walked on the face of the earth. You see, we ought to be supporting of everyone. That's what we are told every day. It's amazing the conversations I have with my own children in my own house about the things that they've been taught at school. We don't want to offend anybody, do we? Here, the Pharisees, they were very offensive. But today they were offended. because their pride was hurt. Their religious authority was challenged. Their righteousness was based upon their own great merit, and they flaunted it. And it caused them to be hollow. Jesus will later equate these leaders as whited sepulchers, or as I heard one preacher say at one time, whited sepulchers. Paul would later level a similar accusation. You remember in Acts 23, he said, God smite thee, thy whited wall, because they sat in judgment. And the Pharisees were concerned that the disciples were eating bread as unclean creatures who had not followed the prescribed trappings of their ritual hierarchy, and they defended them. And this woman, who really is unclean in every sense, she seeks the crumbs from him. Now, what is Jesus going to do here? Upon her first request, did you notice something? In verse 22, behold, a woman of Cana came out at the same coast and cried unto him, saying, have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with a devil. How did he respond? He didn't say a word. Like she wasn't even in the room. Now, we would say today that there was an elephant in the room, wouldn't we? My daughters might say, awkward. She comes in there crying. She has such a great need, and the Lord doesn't say a word at all. And then upon her second request, I'm not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. It's not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. So when she first comes to him and says, my daughter's sick, she has a devil, she's dying, I'm in great pain, we're suffering, he doesn't say a word. And she goes on with her plea, crying after him. And he says this terrible insult about a dog. Now, dogs were unclean to the Jews. It's not a coincidence that Jesus would use the dog to represent the lesson he's trying to teach the apostles. And by the way, I've heard a lot of preachers try to explain this away by saying this is the diminutive sense of the word. And so he said, puppies. Well, all right. The Pharisees, they appeared clean, but they were rotten, weren't they? This woman appeared contaminated, but the fact is she was restored. These folks relied upon their own merit. How many people you know today that are doing that? Good people. If you're a good person tonight, I want to commend you in that. But I also want to tell you that Jesus did not come to save good people. And being a good person never saved anyone. And if you're relying on your own righteousness to get you to heaven, you're never going to make it. I read an article about something that many of you might be interested in. It says this: a Japanese attack on Hawaii is regarded as the most unlikely thing in the world, with one chance in a million of being successful. Besides having more powerful defenses than any other post under the American flag, it is protected by distance. Now, I found this in a book in my house called At Dawn We Slept. This statement went out across the papers September 6, 1941. Now, what happened the next day? The world changed, didn't it? What are we relying on? I want to say something here, and I won't be too preachy, but I find my brethren relying on that city down the road to fix the problems in this country. And if you're relying on that place, I don't know how long you're going to have to wait. But I want to tell you something. If you're relying on the Lord, then you're looking in the right place. I hear so many people ask me, where did it all go wrong? Someone will say, well, when Washington let them take prayer out of the school, that's when it all went wrong. But I want to tell you folks, when the church people started taking prayers out of their homes, that's when it went wrong. It wasn't Washington's fault. It was our fault. And we've let it go inch by inch. We've blamed the schools, and yet we've expected teachers to be our babysitters. We blame the community, yet we never get out into the community. Who are we going to blame on the judgment day for seeing this country spiral into hell? And yet we think Washington can fix it. When the family goes, so goes the church. And when the church goes, there goes the country. It's time that we get back to God. The Lord needs to be the one to clean the swamp. And yet, we allow him to be kept from our children. We don't raise a fuss when he's kept out of the school because we don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to be that guy. We know very little about what's going on. We think we have these little angels, and they could never do any wrong. I heard one fella say, they're not little angels, they're vipers in a diaper. Well, maybe so. I never changed one diaper. You ladies are going to think I'm the worst guy in the world. Not one. I told everybody I was allergic to that stuff. Hey, kids, I feel for you. We live in a world that has forgotten the Lord, and we find a church that has forgotten who their king is. I don't care who you voted for at this point. I'm not going to get into politics either tonight. But I want you to know that whoever was put in there, every one of them in your lifetime, whether you knew it or not, whether you liked them or not, according to Romans 13, was ordained by God. Did you know that? There's only four people in all the world that are ordained by God. One of them is fathers. I want to say something here about fathers. You know the one thing that every prisoner in jail has in common? They grew up without a father. 85% of them grew up without a father. If we could just get godly fathers in this country, we could clear out the jails. God ordained fathers, and we've torn down every bastion that God ever ordained. But God ordained the leader of our land, too. Let me get back to the lesson. Folks, this woman, she was unclean. But she wasn't offended. The Pharisees, they're propagating their own ideas. They're trying to push an agenda. And when Jesus stopped them on it, the first thing they did was get offended. They might walk down the streets and riot. How about that? Or they might put something in the paper, run the church down because they were offended. Or they might make it hard for you to live a little bit. Things might get a little uncomfortable. Jesus wasn't concerned. Matter of fact, these men would kill Jesus before it was over. And here's this woman. And the Lord doesn't answer her. And when he finally does answer, he calls her a dog. What are you relying on tonight, folks? This unclean woman whose life was worse or less than a mongrel dog, a mongrel cur, a feral scavenger. She was begging at the table of God. Give not that which is holy unto the dogs. Mark 7:6. That was the sentiment that was expressed by the chosen people of God. Yet instead of being offended or blaming Christ or charging him with unkindness, she seems rather to suspect herself and lay the fault upon herself. The Pharisees, they were haughty and turned in hate. The woman was humble and she turned for help. They hated Christ because he outwitted them. Their traps never worked. They hated Christ because he unnerved them. You remember Caiaphas? He cried the loudest when Jesus ignored him the most. When Christ didn't answer at first, she continued. Just like that blind man. Remember his neighbor said, shut up, man. You're going to ruin the parade. The prophets come to town and you're going to put your misery on him. Shut up. But he cried even louder. Nothing would keep him from the Lord. And nothing would keep this woman from scaling the mountain. Calvin commented and said, when a door seemed shut, she forced her way through the chinks. She got in, didn't she? What a unique petition. Help me, Lord. Help me. When she first cries out to Jesus, she says, have mercy on me. She's owning the pain of her daughter. Now, I want you to read that again. Lord, have mercy on my daughter. Is that what she said? I want you to think about that. She said, Lord, have mercy on me. Have mercy on me. Ibn al-Tayyib, he was one of the most distinguished medical doctors of the 11th century in the Middle East. And I have a commentary that has been translated recently that he had written. It's a 1,000-year-old commentary. And in it, this doctor commentator notes something I want to read for you. He says this, the woman does not cry out, O Lord, have mercy on my daughter, but rather have mercy on me. He goes on to say this was because her daughter was not able to feel what the mother was enduring. The mother was in pain. And then Ibn al-Tayyib notes that at the end of the story, Jesus does not say, O woman, your daughter is healed. But what does he say? Did you notice? Let it be to you as you desire. And so it's the theologian physician who notices that the caregiver is at the end of her rope, that she also needs healing. Jesus emphasizes with her deep needs and responds to them on two levels. The only time, by the way, anyone else asked Jesus for help, and you might be surprised, but then again, you might not. The only other time anyone asked Jesus for help by using those words, help me, is found in Mark 9, 22 and 24, where there's an account of a child who's possessed with a demon. The Bible says, who would tear him and cast him into the fire often, of whose infirmity was contracted when he was a young boy. In this account, the father is the spokesman on his behalf. He said, oftentimes it's cast him into the fire and into the waters to destroy him. But if thou canst do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Jesus said unto him, if thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. This is a desperate petition. Only a parent knows this pain. And it's not a coincidence that the two people in the Bible, the only two people in the Gospels who come to Jesus and ask their questions and finally get to the point where they just simply could say, Lord, help us, help me, is a desperate parent who feels the pain in their homes. Caregivers who are tired and weary. Help me, Lord. The father of the boy says, don't let my unbelief deter you from healing my child. Don't hold my fault against the boy. Did you notice that? Don't hold my faults. He freely expresses his own faults. The Pharisees had no faults, did they? They pointed them out at everybody else. But this father says, don't hold my faults against the boy. Just save him. Help us, please. And the woman, don't let my uncleanness, the fact that I'm nothing more than an unclean Gentile dog, keep you from healing my little girl. Don't hold my shortcomings against her. Help us. And maybe you've said, help me, Lord. I don't know if you've ever prayed all night. I don't know how long you've prayed. But I know you might start out your prayer very eloquently and have a long one, and you just keep praying it. But you still are full of pain. And you have desires, and you just keep praying, and before long you look up and you realize hours have passed. And now you're getting desperate with the Lord, and you just keep giving him your petition. You first started out by praising him, but now your questions are so desperate, you just keep begging. And by that time the sun has come up in the morning, and you're so tired and you're so exhausted, but the pain is so strong in your heart that you're laying on the ground and the only words that you could utter is, "Help me, Lord, help," because he's the only friend you got. And this woman cries out, "Help me." Did you notice the response of Jesus? He's impressed, isn't he? How about the response of the Pharisees? You know, I like to underline things in my Bible. What did they want to do? See this line right here? In verse 23, "And his disciples came and besought him, saying, 'Send her away.'" I trace it all the way over here. And look at verse 15 of chapter 14. After Jesus finds a desperate crowd of people who are wanting to be fed because they're tired and they're weary. You see what the response of the apostles are there? "When it was evening, the disciples came to him, saying, 'This is a desert place, and the time now past.'" What did they want him to do? Send the multitude away. Send them away. And don't we feel that way sometimes when people come to us in desperation who desperately need the Lord? Sometimes we think it's so overwhelming that we can't even deal with it right now. I've got my own stress. I've got my own problems. My job keeps me so long. Send them away. I don't have time for this right now, Lord. What a multitude. We can't handle that many. And they say of this woman, "Send her away, Lord." What a strange twist. These apostles needed to learn a lot, didn't they? Mark tells us in Mark chapter 7 that he went into a house and would have no man know it. But did you notice what it said? He could not be hid. He couldn't be hid. Praise the Lord. He could not be hid. He's weary. He's fed 5,000. He's had to deal with all of these problems. He's tired. He tries to find a mountain. He climbs it. He tries to hide. He finds a little house, a little hut that he can at least relax for a moment in. And when he gets in there, what happens? The Bible says, even though he hid in that mountain house, he couldn't be hid. And I praise him for it. If Jesus lives in you, praise God, he cannot be hid. If he lives in you, people are going to know it. People are going to know it. You want to convert this city? Get out there. Get out there. And if he lives in you, they're going to know it. You're going to be lively stones. And when they see you, they're going to say, "Something great has happened here." I don't know, maybe some of you might have been scoundrels. People might even know you from back in the day when you were a scoundrel. But when they meet you tonight, they could say, "Man, what happened here? Something great." You could tell them, "Jesus lives in me. Jesus lives in me." But I want to tell you something, folks. If you are outside of Christ and you've let the devil run your life for so long, Jesus won't keep roommates. It's time to kick him out. It's time to kick him out and let Jesus come in. And I want to tell you, when Jesus comes into a house, the devil can't live there any longer. The devil can't live there any longer. He won't have sway over your life anymore. You don't have to be a slave to alcohol anymore. You don't have to be a slave to the drugs anymore. And there is an epidemic this country has never seen. This drug problem we're dealing with now. And it's rocking my community. You don't have to be a slave to the devil anymore if Jesus lives in you. Folks, Jesus won't be hid. If he's in your life, people are going to know it. I'll quit there. I want to offer you an invitation tonight. There are a lot of things that I would have liked to have said, but I run out of time, about this woman. What an inspiring lesson. She threw off any shackles that would keep her from coming to Jesus. This geocentric idea that Jehovah was only the God of Israel meant nothing when she left that house. Folks, you can come to the table of God tonight. You remember when Naaman came down to Israel? Naaman came down from Syria. He had leprosy. And he went down to Israel, and the prophet's man met him there and said, you know, if you dip yourself 7 times in the old Jordan, you're going to be saved. And he said, the Abana and the Farfar River up in Syria, that's the cleanest rivers in the world. You mean I've come all the way down here to dip in the Jordan? Have any of you ever been to the Jordan? Well, what's this creek right out here? What's this called here?
Warm Springs Run.
Warm Springs Run. Get pretty dirty sometimes? That's about the way the Jordan looks. You ever swim in this? Washington did, didn't he? Well, when I was in Israel, I didn't get in the Jordan much. Every once in a while I get down in it, but I thought it was really dirty. And I grew up around Captina Creek. And we had a beautiful creek because it was right below the coal mine. And so sometimes you'd come out glowing, and that was really neat. But the Jordan ain't much different. Excuse my grammar. You take a hillbilly, and you put him over in Israel, you know what he does? I rented four-wheelers, and we went four-wheeling in the Jordan. There wasn't nothing magical in there, I'm telling you that. Nothing magical at all. I came out as dirty as can be. My four-wheelers got stuck. Luckily, there were redneck Israelites who pulled me out. But here, Naaman says, we've got the Abana and the Farfar, and they're clean. You want me to dip in the Jordan? And he went down, and he came up, and he went down, and he came up. He went down, and he came up, and he kept doing it 4, 5, 6 times. And finally, he went down the 7th, and he came up clean. And when he got out of the water, he was healed. And he wanted to go back to Syria and tell them all about the God of the land of Israel. And so he's healed by God, but he still didn't quite get the message, does he? He's still thinking geocentrically. Do you remember? Go home tonight and read a little bit more. Do you remember what he took back with him? He took an ox cart load of dirt with him. Why'd he do that? My grandfather went all over this country and all over countries across the big water. And every time he came back, he didn't bring me cool stuff. He didn't bring me money. He didn't bring me souvenirs. He brought me dirt and sand. Thanks a lot, Pap. Really appreciate that. This guy, he loads up an ox cart load of dirt and takes it back. Why? Because he wanted to build an altar to Jehovah, and he thought that it had to be there in that land. You see, he missed the boat. Many of you have been to the Church of Christ. You might have even stepped at the aisle and been baptized, but you never realized the power of God in your life. Tonight, you might be back. And I want to tell you, God is not just the God over Washington or Berkeley Springs or Bellsville, Ohio. He rules in all the lands of the world. Still today. This woman, she didn't care about that. Many, many years earlier, there was a woman who lived in the same place that Jesus was this night, the widow of Zarephath. Do you remember her? And Elijah, he came up and he wanted to stay there, and he said, pour me some drink and give me some food, give me a morsel. And she said, I've got one more morsel. Me and my boy are going to share it, and then we're going to die. Kind of like Eeyore, right? Thanks for noticing, but go on. But she felt, well, maybe your God can do something. And so she gave her food to Elijah, and he stayed there, and she was blessed, and they ate well. And she never went hungry again. The only problem was her son died that night. Her son died that night. And the prophet cried out to the Lord, don't do this. And he laid down on top of the dead boy because the widow was crying. And he laid down 3 times. And when he got up the 3rd time, the boy was saved. Is it any wonder that this miracle happened in that spot to a little child? And is it any wonder that the prophet, who cared so much for the widow of another land, could be echoed in the words of Jesus when he said, thy faith has made thee whole? Please come.